Genesis chapter 39 is where we find ourselves today. And as we do each week, I want to share with you and remind us of the, and I know these are kind of grayed out on the overhead, but I want to share with you again the parallels between Joseph and Yeshua, our Messiah. No other person in the entire Torah, in the Hebrew Scriptures, no other person has a life that parallels so closely our Messiah's as Joseph. And the ones that are grayed out are ones we've gone over, but I want us to look at a few others we're going to add to our list. First of all, he is the opposite of Satan. Now, this is not something that is just, it just says, it's something that's hidden in there. And of course, as you read the story of Joseph, you're going to see that he and Satan don't have a whole lot in common. He brought blessing wherever he went. He was tempted. And the writer of Hebrews tells us that Yeshua is tempted in every way as we are. And yet, he did not fall. He did not give in. He did not succumb to the temptation. He was falsely accused twice. Now, we know that Messiah was falsely accused by two false witnesses, whereas with Joseph, he was accused by one false witness two times. And Yeshua lost his cloak. Joseph lost his as well. And there's also one other, I didn't quite know how to put on the list, but we know that when Joseph's brothers, because of their jealousy, they put him into the pit, they put him into the ground. He came out from the ground, and then he went among the Gentiles. It's a picture of his death, his burial, his resurrection, and then going to call a Gentile bride to himself. But we also see that pictured again here in this chapter. Because you see, it's not just the Jewish people who have to a great degree rejected Messiah. It's the Gentiles as well. And we see him coming into Potiphar's house, bringing tremendous blessing. But because of Potiphar's wife and her lustful spirit, he again is rejected and he's put down into the prison. But later he's going to be brought forth and he's going to rise in glory. So we see this twice in Joseph's life, as being rejected and then going down, but then being brought up. Once at the hand of his Jewish brothers, and once at the hand of the Gentiles. You see, we're all guilty in his death. And whenever one group points their finger at the other group and says, you're to blame, well, it's like my old Sunday school teacher used to say, when you point somebody else, you got three fingers pointing back at you, and that's very true. It's very true. Well, anyways, let's get back into our chapter 39. And I'm going to go through and make a few comments. We will then go back, and I want us to look at the nature of the temptation and of Joseph's resistance to Potiphar's wife. And it says in verse 1, and Joseph had been brought down to Egypt. Now that word brought down, as it is used here in the Hebrew text, it's the word hurad, hurad. It's only found two times in the entire Bible in that form. It's four letters, hurad. He was brought down. One place is here, referring to Joseph. The other place it's found is over in Isaiah chapter 14, verse 11. And there it is speaking of Satan. And this is what it says, your pomp is brought down to hell, to Sheol. To the sound of your harps, maggots are laid as a bed beneath you, and worms are your covers. How are you fallen from heaven, O day star, son of dawn? How you are cut down to the ground, you who laid the nations low. It's interesting, isn't it? This one word, horad, is used only two times. One of Joseph, who came as a servant, and he is brought down into Egypt. But then after that, he is elevated and brought up to a place of rulership and of control. Whereas Satan is in the place of rulership and control because he wanted to be like God, and as a result, he is brought down. You know, it's that principle that God will reject the proud and he'll elevate the humble. And if we humble ourselves in the eyes of the Lord, he will lift us up in due time. But he'll take the proud and he will bring them down. This is one of those spiritual laws that you can always, 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 always count on. There are no exceptions to this. The person who is proud and self-centered will be humiliated, period. No exceptions. And the person who lives a life of humility, not self-pity, they look alike, but they are opposites, but of true humility. And remember, humility is not thinking lowly of yourself. Humility is just not thinking about yourself at all. And a person who practices humility, pursues humility, he will or she will be lifted up in due time. Ironclad principle. It's as sure as the law of gravity. Well, as we go on, it says, Joseph had been brought down to Egypt. Potiphar, a courtier or a chief of Pharaoh, the chamberlain of the butchers, a prominent Egyptian, purchased him from the Ishmaelites who had brought him down there. Adonai was with Joseph. Now, I want you to pay attention to something. In the entire account of Joseph, you know, this whole last chunk of Genesis is all about Joseph. And in the entire account of Joseph, God's name is never used except in this chapter. And in this chapter, the chapter in which he is tempted by Potiphar's wife, God's name is used 8 times. Now, there is one other place where God's name is found. It's over in chapter 49, and when Jacob is speaking, and he's prophesying that the Messiah will come. It's in Genesis 49, verse 18, where Jacob says, I await your Yeshua, O Lord. And that, O Lord, that's the only other place in the whole story of Joseph where God's four-letter name, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, is found. But in this chapter, which seems to be the place that's the most fleshly, the most ugly, the place where this woman, this married woman, is trying to tempt Joseph to sin with her. In this chapter, God's name is found 8 times. Keep that in mind. But you can count them as we go. Verse 2, Adonai was with Joseph, and he became a successful man, and he remained in the house of his Egyptian master. His master perceived that Adonai was with him, and whatever he did, Adonai made succeed in his hand. Joseph found favor in his eyes, and he attended him. He appointed him over his household, and whatever he had, he placed in his hand. It's interesting in Hebrew, that phrase, and whatever he had, he placed in his hand. In Hebrew, it's 5 words, and they are the words, V'kol yesh lo natan biyado. And if you take the last letters of each of those 5 words, the last letter of each of those 5 words, in order, it spells his tongue. I mean, these are the kinds of things the rabbis do. I mean, they just delve into the scriptures, into the jots and tittles. And they've noticed these 5 words, take the last letter of each of those words, in order, it spells the shano, his tongue. And they draw from this that one of the reasons God prospered Joseph so well in everything he did is because he had control of his tongue. Now, one of the things we could have added to our list, I just forgot it this morning when I was putting this together, and is that when Yeshua was led before his accusers, did he defend himself? No. Did Joseph defend himself when he was brought before his accuser, Potiphar's wife? No. As a sheep is silent before its shearers, he did not open his mouth. That's what it prophesies of Yeshua. The same applies to Joseph. So add that to your list as well. He knew how to control his tongue. And I really believe there's a principle here. If we can control our tongues, then whatever is placed in our hand will prosper. I think there's a principle here. We think of tongues and hands as being two different things, but they both can work tremendous good or ill, one in the physical world and one in the spiritual. We need to be careful what we say. Verse 5, and it happened that from the time he appointed him in his house and over whatever he had, Adonai blessed the Egyptian's house on Joseph's account. So that Adonai's blessing was in whatever he owned, in the house and in the field. You know, I was tempted to get into that a bit, in the house and in the field. It didn't have to add that phrase, but God saw fit to add that phrase in, because in the house, the internal, and in the field, the external, he's trying to draw our attention to something here. Some people can have a very rich external life, but inside they're empty, they're poverty stricken. Other people may on the outside look like they own nothing, and they may own nothing, but inside they are rich, they are full, and they are satisfied and happy. And when you have Joseph in your life, when you have Yeshua in your life, and you've committed everything you have to his hand, he will prosper you in the house, and he'll prosper you in the field. Everything's going to be fine, and you don't have to worry about it. And then it goes on, verse 6, he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and with him present he concerned himself with nothing. Boy, I wish we could be that way. Concern ourselves with nothing. We could be anxious for nothing. That's something that we should strive for, to be anxious for nothing if we've truly invited Messiah into our lives and yielded to him lordship. Except for the bread he ate. And we'll come back to that later, chapters down the road. We'll come back to that phrase and explain it. Now, Joseph was handsome of form and handsome of appearance. Now, someone else in Genesis was described that way, as being attractive in form, no, strong body, and also of appearance, handsome face. Who else is described that way? Oh, you're so forgetful. You don't listen to anything I say, do you? Thank you, Andy. Yes, it was Joseph's mother, Rachel. Remember when Jacob he fled from his brother Esau and he came to the area where his uncle Laban lived. He laid eyes on Rachel and he was smitten because she was beautiful of form and also she was beautiful of appearance. Well, her son Joseph inherited those qualities. In verse 7, it says, after these things, his master's wife cast her eyes upon Joseph, and she said, lie with me. You know, this is what the world is telling us all the time. Don't stand. Lay down. Don't make progress. Lay down right here with me. That is the cry of the world toward us, toward everyone. But he adamantly refused. It's very interesting here that the Hebrew doesn't say, but he didn't want to. The Hebrew does not say that he thought she was ugly. It says he refused. That word refused in the Hebrew means that was something he was drawn to do, but he said no. He was tempted. He was a young, red-blooded male who had natural sexual drives. And here is the invitation and the opportunity. But he refused. He refused. We're going to come back to this and see why it's important that we refuse. And especially for you young people, why you need to refuse these invitations that may come your way before you're married. He adamantly refused. He said to his master's wife, look, with me here, my master concerns himself about nothing in the house and whatever he has placed in my custody. There is no one greater in this house than I, and he has denied me nothing but you, since you are his wife. How then can I perpetrate this great evil and have sinned against God? You see how Joseph realized he's God's servant first and foremost. And when I sin with you, I'm sinning against him. There's a legend that at one time Joseph came so close to giving in to this temptation. And at the last moment he looked up and he saw his father Jacob's face. And when he saw his father's face, he had the strength to refuse her. You know, if we could have the presence of mind when we are tempted, whether it's a sexual temptation or whatever temptation it is, if we could have the presence of mind to think, would I do this if my father or my mother were here with me, watching? Would I do this if one of the elders, one of my friends, someone I respect, if Yeshua himself were in this room watching? Well, I have news for you. You're being watched. And what you do will be proclaimed from the rooftops, as I was sharing last time we were together. And what you refuse to do will also be shouted from the rooftops. Your failures and your victories, they're all going to be replayed. Now, you know, several people over the last couple of weeks have brought this up to me in conversation, talking about Judgment Day and so on. Maybe we need to revisit this just for a moment. Because, you know, we're all aware that God says that I'll remove your sins from you as far as the east is from the west. You know, I'll bury them at the depths of the sea. I'll remember your sins no more. And that's true. It doesn't mean he's forgetful. It just simply means he chooses not to recall them. He chooses not to dredge them up again. But see, that's God's viewpoint toward your sin. But that does not change the fact that everything you say, everything you do, good or bad, is recorded. It's recorded in your life. Your life is a book that's being written in by everything you do and everything you say. Do you ever notice in Revelation where it talks about how the book of life is brought out and the other books? In Judaism, I mean, this is a very common thing in Judaism, that everyone's life is a book. Every single life is a book. Every one of you. This is a library of books. You are all a complete story, and your story is being written. And once you die, your story is complete. You see? And when it's time to review your life, your life is laid out there for what it is. What you did is not changed. It's done. It's recorded. And it will be seen and viewed by everyone who has ever lived, is living, or ever will live. You're thinking, oh, I mean, you're all thinking, oh, I am too. I'm thinking, oh, I don't want that to happen. But we have to understand two other things here. Many more, but two things in particular. One is, we're going to look upon this not as we are now. We're going to look back on our lives from how we will be then, with deeper understanding, with an appreciation of what God has done in our lives and is doing in our lives. And also, and this is the best part, you're going to see how everything that happened in your life, good or bad, is somehow used by God. You're going to see every connection between your life and every other life as it rippled out into places you're completely unaware of. You know, I know in my life, God used some real boneheaded people to touch my life as a mirror to me, to show me errors in my life, or just to reveal things in me, or just to bring discipline in my life, or whatever. And God's used me as the boneheaded person in many other lives, including many of yours. All right? So in other words, God has used sins in other people's lives to do a work in mine. And I have to believe that even the failures of my own life, he somehow is able to use in the lives of others. Pharaoh is the great example. Did Pharaoh harden his heart? Yeah. Did God harden Pharaoh's heart? Yeah. Was Pharaoh a sinner? Oh, yeah. And yet God used Pharaoh, and Paul tells us in Romans that God had raised him up for that, so that it'd be a display of God's glory. I mean, what if Pharaoh had caved at the very first plague? Oh, I give up. Let him go. We'd be missing 9/10 of the story. But God hardened his heart because he needed Pharaoh as a backdrop to display God's glory. You know, it's a wonderful thing. Yes, Mark, go right ahead. Very good. Yeah. Psalm 139:16.
I'm just wondering, when we see our life projected in eternity, will he also show us what our life would have been like had we done all the right things, made all the right decisions?
That's the great question. The question is, will we see what our life would have been like, could have been like? You know, there's a rabbi, one of my favorite teachers. His name is, what is his name? Aharon, oh, I can't think of his last name. Aaron, Jake, is it Jacob Aaron? I think it's Jacob Aaron. My mind is blanked out. But he says Judgment Day for us is going to be a double feature. First, we're going to see our life as it is, as we lived it. We may actually look at it and say, oh, well, it could have been a lot worse. It wasn't so bad. He says, but the second feature is going to be what your life could have been. He says, and that's the one that's going to cause us pain. And that's the one we're going to have tears that God will have to wipe away when we see what our life could have been. So that's what he teaches. And you know what? There might be a lot of truth in that. You know, when we look back on our lives from the viewpoint of being in God's presence and knowing things as he knows them, how could we not but help see our lives as they could have been? So, because we'll see every wasted potential, every wasted opportunity. We'll see every single one of them. So, that's an interesting question. All right, shall we move on a bit? We could spend a lot more time talking about Judgment Day, but that's what Yom Kippur is for. Verse 10 says, and so it was, just as she coaxed Joseph day after day, so he would not listen to her to lie beside her, to be with her. Then there was an opportune day when he entered the house to do his work, no man of the household staff being there in the house. Then she caught hold of him by his garment, saying, lie with me. Now remember, clothing is always a picture of the body. And you know, temptation, the enemy, things in this world can grab your body and do things to you. But your soul is still independent and you can decide what you're going to do in response. You can always make that decision. There's never this, well, I had no choice. Oh, you always have a choice. You just made the wrong one. It's like George MacDonald's describing this young man off at college in the 1800s. And he liked to spend more time in the bars than he in the pubs than he did it in the classroom. And at one point in the book, it just jumped out at me. He talked about this young man. He said he went to the pub and someone offered him a pint. He figured he could take it or leave it, so he took it. And I think so many times we could take it or leave it, and we take it. Isn't that true? But he left his garment in her hand, and he fled and went outside. When she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and fled outside, she called out to the men of her household and spoke to them. So she called these men in who were probably outside at the time. Look, he brought us, accusing her husband, he brought us a Hebrew man to mock us. He came to lie with me, but I called out with a loud scream. And when he heard that I raised my voice and screamed, he left his garment beside me, fled, and went outside. You see, now she had gotten herself into a mess. Because once she grabbed his garment and Joseph realized, I either go with the garment or I go out without it. And he left. People are going to see him like, Joseph, where are your clothes? So what does he do? Explain what she tried to do. And when they come in and see her with his garment, is she going to admit, yeah, I grabbed him trying to get him to lay down with me, but he wouldn't. She's not going to do that. So the very fact that she has his garment and he doesn't puts her in a place where she either has to lie, she has to lie to defend herself and accuse him, or she has to confess up. She chose to lie. So she kept his garment, verse 16, kept his garment beside her until his master came home. Then she told a similar account, saying, so here's the second accusation. The Hebrew slave. Now, notice she called him a man back in verse 14. But here, talking to her husband, calls him a slave. The Hebrew slave whom you brought to us came to me to mock me. But it happened that when I raised my voice and screamed, he left his garment beside me and ran outside. And it was when his master heard his wife's words, which he spoke to him, saying, your slave did these things like these to me. His anger flared up. Very interesting point. I want you to pay attention here. Potiphar was smarter than we often give him credit. It doesn't say his anger flared up against Joseph. It just says his anger flared up. And I believe that Potiphar knew exactly what happened. Because you see, if he really believed this slave had tried to molest his wife, Joseph would have been executed. No questions asked. but he didn't execute him. In fact, you'll see when he puts him in prison, he puts him in the best part of the prison, where the king's prisoners are, not down in the dungeons where they just, you know, lock people away and that they're never thought of again. Potiphar realized what was going on. And a wonderful thing here too, poetic justice. Potiphar's wife, who wanted Joseph so badly, she didn't get him. But according to the Torah, her daughter did. Because later when we see Pharaoh giving a wife to Joseph, her name is Potipharah, and she's called the daughter of Potiphar. Isn't that wonderful? So anyways, so it says his anger flared up, and I think it was against his wife, not Joseph. Then Joseph's master took him and placed him in the prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he remained there in prison. Adonai was with Joseph, and he endowed him with chesed. Chesed. Chesed literally means loving kindness, but it's also often a word that also means chen, grace. He endowed him with loving kindness, with grace. I want us to learn one principle from this story. There are many to learn, but I want you to remember this. We in our minds, want the world to operate according to the way we think it should operate. But we talked about this several weeks ago. And we have this wired into us that if I resist temptation, I do the right thing, and I suffer for righteousness' sake, then all of a sudden this blessing should start coming my way. Blessing will come your way, but not right now necessarily. Not right away. In fact, you might do the right thing and find yourself in more hot water than if you hadn't. Yeshua never sinned, and he was crucified. Paul has turned the world upside down with the good news of the gospel. He's beaten and imprisoned and shipwrecked and stoned and whipped. And I mean, it was until he started following Yeshua, he had a pretty cakey life. I mean, it was not too tough. But when he started following the Lord, that's when the problems came. In fact, he said, he wrote that it was committed to him to fulfill and to fill up what was lacking in the suffering of Messiah. Because you know, Yeshua, he was a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief. Right? But he suffered terribly to bring the gospel and make the gospel a reality. On the other hand, Paul suffered all his life to publish that gospel to the world. And so Yeshua and Paul, the one who is sinless and the chief of sinners, become partners. That's a wonderful picture. And he suffered all his life to bring about the gospel that Yeshua suffered to make a reality. And so don't start thinking because you've done the right thing, because this is what the enemy will do. He'll come along and say, well, you did the right thing, and look at you now. Right? And often, when we've done the wrong thing, the enemy will come along and say, well, good, nobody caught you. You got away with it. You know, you never get away with anything. You never get away with anything. It's just a matter of time. So don't be shocked when you do the right thing and things turn sour. Don't be surprised. Be patient. Be patient. And let God finish the plan. God's writing the book. We're writing it along with him. And let's make wise decisions. Let's do what's right regardless of the cost. And it says, and he put his favor in the eyes of the prison warden. The prison warden placed all inmates of the prison in Joseph's custody. And everything that was done there, he would accomplish. The prison warden did not scrutinize anything that was in his charge, inasmuch as Adonai was with him. And whatever he did, Adonai made successful. You know, throughout the account of Joseph, we find this reference to these chiefs or wardens or whatever you want to call them. In Hebrew, the word is sar, sometimes translated prince, generally translated a chief, an overseer, a sar. It is the root of the Russian word tsar. And as I was amazed, I had a chuckle, as I was reading through a commentary by Rabbi Hirsch. And it was written back, I think, the 1830s, somewhere around there. Don't hold me to that date. It was written almost 200 years ago. And Hirsch is commenting on the fact that you always see these SARs. And in our present political climate, where we have these new things called czars that don't have to pass any kind of scrutiny by any constitutional process, with that in mind, listen to what Hirsch wrote almost 20 years ago. Here we have yet another czar. The more a people is enslaved, the more czars it will have. I thought, that really pegs it. That's prophetic in a way I don't think you ever realized. I don't like talking politics from up here, so I'm going to talk about language a little bit. One of the things the enemy has always done is try to control the language. And one of the ways it's being done in these days is with this word capitalism. Capitalism is really getting a bad rap these days. But you have to understand, Karl Marx invented the name capitalism to substitute for the word freedom. You understand? Because who doesn't want freedom? Everybody wants freedom. Everybody loves freedom. And throughout history, people have laid down their lives to protect their freedom. But Karl Marx didn't like freedom. He had to change the language. So he invented the word capitalism. Well, there's a new word. And then he describes capitalism as something negative, something that's dangerous, something that feeds greed, and so on. In fact, there's a movie out now called Capitalism, A Love Story. The whole thing is put out by a multimillionaire talking about how rotten capitalism is in America. Do you understand what's happening here? So when you hear people knocking capitalism, remember, what is capitalism? Oh, freedom. That's right. It's freedom. Don't get confused by the language. Understand things for what they are. It's like you take the word drunk, you make it alcoholic. You take the word addiction, you say, oh no, it's a disease. You take someone who has been self-centered and selfish all their lives and has refused to do the right thing and refused to work and to use their talents, and they become very turned in on themselves, their lives become very dark, and we want to call that mental illness. You see, we take the reality, stick another label on it, and then we can make it whatever we want. And the word says we are to connect spiritual words with spiritual things. We want to put the right label on the right things. Words are so powerful. They're so important. God created this world by his word. The word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we should be very careful how we use words, because words mean things. Okay? So let's make sure we understand what words mean. I want us to go back for a moment. I wasn't sure whether I would do this or not, and the more, as the week progressed, I kept thinking, I have to get into this. Because we live in a time where sexual purity is considered puritanical. There's another word for you. You know, you go back and you read about the way the Puritans really were. They loved to eat. They loved to laugh. They loved to tell jokes. And this whole idea of what we have, what we've been told puritanical is not the case of what it was. And this summer, about a dozen couples or so from Beth Tikkun, we got together for 6 weeks in a row. We had dinner together. Then we went through a video, what do you call it, a conference or whatever, where a series of DVDs called Laugh Your Way to a Better Marriage by Mark Gunger. And when I first encountered this, I thought, well, that's kind of a dippy name, Laugh Yourself to a Better Marriage. You know, I can't imagine many spiritual concepts where you'd say laugh your way to spiritual maturity, you know, whatever. But you know, for marriage, laughter is the perfect way. And if you go back several weeks, we're talking about Yitzchak, Isaac, whose name means laughter. We understand what laughter is. That's the best way in the world to understand the concepts of marriage. So anyways, we went through this DVD course, and it was just a blessing to me, and I think to everyone else who participated. But there's one of the DVDs where he talks about sexuality, and there were so many wonderful things there that I wish all of our singles could hear. I want all of them to hear. And I wish all of the married people here could have heard, you know, years ago. Because there's so much deception being fed to us through the media, through the schools, through movies and books and magazines and news articles, and it's filled with lies, lie after lie after lie after lie. And what I want to do is restore some balance and some truth to this. Because, you see, these days it's very, very tough for a young lady or a young man to be tempted sexually and to resist. Because there's not much that's been brought into their life to explain to them why they should resist. The benefits of resisting, when it seems like all the benefits come with giving in. You see? And like Mark Gunger says, we're in a war where it seems like the other team, the other side, has all the bullets. And we're not giving our kids any of the bullets to fire back. And so in that teaching, and I went over it several more times, and took some notes to share with you. So I'm about to share with you is from him, all right? Not from me so much. And one of the things he shares is this, and I will explain why. Sex outside of marriage is always destructive. It's always damaging. It always, always, always messes things up. And your marriage, you can still have a good marriage afterward. It will never be what it could have been. And it'll always be more difficult. There'll be more things that you'll have to deal with. You still have a good marriage. But when you crack that foundation, you're making things tougher. It will mess things up. Now, something he did not share, but as I think about this, I was reminded of. When I was a young man, I read C.S. Lewis's book. Most people are not aware of this book he wrote, but it's called The Pilgrim's Regress. Now, we're all familiar with The Pilgrim's Progress, you know, John Bunyan's book, where this young man called Pilgrim, you know, he's got a burden of sin and he goes through, and it's a great story. We've all heard it a million times. It's wonderful stuff, wonderful stuff. But The Pilgrim's Regress is C.S. Lewis's take, where he's got a young man who decides he wants to find the truth, and what he encounters are all the false philosophies. All the false philosophies that have been around for hundreds of years and still around today. And one of the philosophies he encounters early on is hedonism, just giving into the flesh, just doing what feels good. Kind of like what's the philosophy of the day now. And here the young man, every day there's this beautiful petite blonde girl who comes out of the woods, and she just loves him to death, you know, and every day they just get together and he's just delighted. And this goes on and on and on for months. And then he decides he's going to move on, that this is not where truth is, this is not what's truly fulfilling. And so the last day she comes out of the woods and there are hundreds of children with her. And he says, where did all these kids come from? She says, they're all yours. And he was shocked. And she said, you thought we could do what we did and there wouldn't be a child? She says, every encounter produced a child. And C.S. Lewis, in this brilliant way, he's letting us know every sexual encounter outside of marriage does produce offspring. Always. May not be a little baby girl or a little baby boy, but it's producing something that's going to follow you. Probably something very destructive. But every sexual encounter produces offspring. C.S. Lewis knew that. He brought it. You know, that was something I'm glad I read when I was young. It really helped protect me. But back to what Mark Gunger was sharing. I'm going to start with the men. One of the things that's been proven is that when men, in their early sexual encounters, what happens is imprinting. And I remember taking studying zoology and psychology in college, and it talks about imprinting. And when animals are born, at some point shortly after birth, it may be a few days or a few weeks, there's this one certain point where this animal is ready to imprint. And when it opens its eyes, the first thing it sees, it becomes mama. whether it's a pig or an eagle or a human being or whatever, that thing becomes mom. You know, you see all these stories about how a goose and a Rottweiler are like best friends because the Rottweiler thinks the goose is mama. That's because somewhere when that Rottweiler was a puppy, one particular point it opened its eyes, saw the goose, and thought, this is my mama, and follows the goose around everywhere. When men have that first sexual encounter, it's like taking pictures. And what happens, because that sexual encounter took place in the context of lust, and not marriage, not love, but just lust, what happens, it imprints on the person, imprints on the man, and then he wants to repeat that. He wants to repeat those conditions in which he had that encounter. And as a result, one of the damaging things this brings into men's lives is the inability to enjoy sexuality in marriage. Mark Gunger shares the example of a man who came to him. He was married, and he told him, I couldn't care less about having sex. And Mark Gunger asked him, he says, well, before you were married, were you sexually active? The guy says, oh yeah, really. And Mark says, well, do you and your wife ever have any intimacy? He says, yeah, once in a while. He says, well, what do you do? He says, well, we'll go out to dinner, we'll take a little trip, go to a real nice hotel, and, you know. He says, well, tell me about your encounters before you're married. He says, oh, I'd go to the bars, and I would pick out some woman, and I'd warm up to her, and we'd go out, we'd have a nice meal, and then we would go to a hotel room. And Mark says, do you see what you're doing? Because you were so sexually active before marriage, and this is the context, this is the script you followed for those encounters. Now that you're married, it's very difficult for you to enjoy that intimacy without following the same script, because you centered sexuality in lust. And now that you're married, it's almost impossible for you to really enjoy what God has made for you. Now, there's ways to fix that. There's a way to repair that, but it takes lots of work. You know, when sexuality takes place in the context of marriage, and a man has saved himself until that day, how does he imprint then? You know, all the family, all the friends have all gathered together. They're in a sanctuary of some sort, and it's all decorated. There's music. Everybody's happy. The parents come up and they give the bride to him. You know, and there's prayer and there's blessing. There's a huge celebration and a party. And then comes the wedding night. And because that first experience has been framed with this wonderful frame, that everybody says, this is a good thing. This is good. This is wonderful. We celebrate it. It says, then the guy imprints not on the lust. He imprints on the girl. It's on the woman. It's on the girl. It's on his wife. It's on his beloved. Not on the back seat of a car. Not on a hotel room. Not on, and this is the bit of it. It's all focused on her. And people who wait till marriage have a fraction of the divorce rate of the people who have sexual encounters outside of marriage. In fact, the divorce rate right now between those who are believers, church-going people, synagogue-going people, and non-believers, it's not the same. Among believers, it's actually a little higher. So, guys, those sexual encounters prior to marriage, very damaging. Very damaging. And you are cracking up the foundation for your marriage. And you are really damaging the wonder and the power, the dynamo that sexual intimacy is supposed to be. You're destroying it. Now, women, it's different. Women don't imprint so much upon the sexual encounter itself. They imprint on what happens after. And when sexuality takes place outside of marriage, nothing happens after it. because there's no commitment. There's no future. There's no real connection, because after a while, they break up and they go on and have another encounter. And so eventually, after many sexual partners to woman, what happens is sex equals nothing. And so it's very difficult for a woman who's had many sexual partners to really have a rich physical intimacy, physical relationship with her husband later on. In fact, scientists, and Mark Gunger brings this up, when I went on the internet to read more about it, it was amazing reading. He talks about, this is something, it happens in men and women, but especially in women, there is a, I guess it's a hormone, called oxytocin. Oxytocin is released when, after a sexual encounter, especially the first one, there's all this oxytocin released in her body. And they call this the connection hormone, because it's something that causes a person to attach mentally and emotionally with someone else. In fact, when a woman nurses her baby, oxytocin is released. And it causes the bonding, that strong bonding between a woman and her child. They're even shared on the internet. I was reading on Wikipedia, and it talked about a test that had been done where they took some people, and they took half the group, the test group, and they actually injected them with oxytocin. And then they had the people listen to a sales pitch, which is really kind of a stupid sales pitch. And the people who had been injected with the oxytocin were all much more trusting of the sales pitch. They're all ready to buy. I thought, oh, this is great, because this thing, it was making them attach. Well, what happens when a woman has a number of sexual partners? Her oxytocin levels reduce, eventually just kind of turn off. How sad. You see, in the world and in the sex education classes, what you're going to hear about are the physical dangers of having unprotected sex. As long as you have protected sex, it's okay, you know, and blah, 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 blah. They never talk about the psychological scarring. They never talk about the spiritual damage it causes. They never talk about what you're losing and the damage it's going to cause to the relationship you have with that special one when they do come into your life, that man, that woman. They never talk about that, because that's not important. Because everything in sex education is lust-based. Lust-based. And then they just want to talk about the anatomy of it. But the thing is, in God's economy, sexuality is spiritually based. And this thing, this powerful dynamo, which takes two people and makes them one. And out of this, life is created. Life burst out onto the scene. I mean, every one of us is here as a result of a sexual encounter. You see? I mean, sex is something that's so important to God. It is the thing he's created, because there is nothing else in this world he could create to show the power of how life is brought out. And it's always by two becoming one. And when two become one, life is the result. You see, when two friends form a friendship, just two men, two women, a man and a woman, just friendship itself, no sexuality involved, friendship produces life. You see, as we come together as one, life is results from this. Whenever things come together and unite, life is a result, if they come together in the right way. But the epitome of that is a man and a woman, a husband and a wife, in the context of a marriage, of a celebration, which requires self-discipline and waiting and saying no, 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 until finally there's a wedding, then you say yes. And when that happens, the spiritual anatomy of that relationship, that physical relationship, is healthy and strong and good and life-giving. Okay? That is the message we need to share with young people. I want young people here to hear that. Yes, Sharon. Okay, go right ahead. Yes.
The same studies show that men
Isn't that amazing? Isn't that something?
It's not just a physical act. That's where the emotional aspect comes from. These are very cutting-edge studies that are very, very new. And not surprising.
I'm going to try to repeat that for the sake of the microphone recording. Dr. Stern just shared cutting-edge research on oxytocin related to men and says it's been shown, demonstrated in testing, that men release oxytocin only when it's an encounter with their wife. And that's the bonding that takes place. And there again, it's that focusing on the girl instead of focusing on the lust. Focusing on the girl. Yeah. I want to use some strong language here. It's not dirty language, it's strong language. I want to drive a point home. I've thought about this. I didn't even ask Robin if I should do this because I'm afraid she'd say no. So now all she can do is tell me I shouldn't have. But maybe she'll agree and say I should. But men, I want to tell you something. Listen to this. Maybe instead of seeing Jacob's face like Joseph did or seeing your father's face, maybe you'll remember Grant sitting up here on the stool saying this to you. And that's this. Guys, if you engage in sexuality, sexual encounters, before you're married, you're not a man, you're an animal. And you are a slave to your glands rather than a bondservant to your Lord. What did Joseph say to Potiphar's wife when she tried to seduce him? He said, "You're his wife. Then can I perpetrate this great evil and have sinned against God?" You see, animals don't have a concept of God. So therefore, when they have an encounter with another dog, a cat, a horse, bird, whatever it is, it's nature. You're called to be more than an animal. You're called to do more than just to cave in to the glands that are trying to drive you to behave like an animal. One of the reasons you have such strong temptations as a healthy young man, just as Joseph did, is so you can become stronger as a man. You see? If saying no to those encounters was easy, then what's to be gained? But when everything in your body is screaming out and you say no, what you're doing, you're walking in the Spirit. And all of that appetite you have now, you'll have in spades when you're married. And there will be no regrets. But I promise you, if you cave in, there'll be nothing but regrets. So you may get a momentary release like an animal. But since you are not an animal, you'll have nothing but regret the rest of your life for what you did. And it's not just about you. That's another soul you're having sex with. You're causing damage in her life as well. And girls, if you engage in sex before marriage, you're an idiot. In fact, Mark Gunger says you're an idiot of Titanic proportions. And I agree. You are a fool and you are an idiot because you are giving away the one thing that man wants and only your husband deserves. You're a fool. If you think for one moment that guy is going to be committed to you because you gave him your body, you're just as stupid and you're dumb as dirt. I don't know how else to put it. You're an idiot. Knock it off. Repent. Correct it. You can never fix it. But you can stop now and allow God to begin doing a work of restoration in your life. You understand? All right. So, maybe the next time you're really tempted, you'll see me up here calling you an idiot and an animal. And you say, "I don't think I'm going to do this." And if so, then it was worth it. It was worth it. You know, God loves us so much that he gave us sexuality. It's an incredible gift, and it comes from Him, and He's given us a particular way to be engaged. I know I've used this example many times before, but I don't know of a better one. But I heard someone share once that sexuality, or sex itself, is like a river. As long as the river is inside its banks, it's flowing within its banks, it is beautiful. Riverside property is the most expensive of all, right? It's beautiful. It's powerful. It is life-giving. But when that river floods over its banks, and now that's not contained, it is ugly, it is deadly, it stinks. Right? Same river, but one is inside the banks, one's overflowed the banks. And so you see, God has given us banks in which sexuality can flow and move. He's given us banks. Within those banks, it's all good. It's all good. Outside those banks, it's destructive and damaging. Sex is like fire. Is fire good or bad? Well, it's wonderful if it's in the fireplace. But you let that fire get out of the fireplace and into the living room, not so good anymore. You see? It's like so many things. But there are few things in life more powerful than this one thing. So treat it with great respect. It's a tremendous gift. And don't waste it. Don't waste it. Invest it. Robin, you're about to tell me I shouldn't have said that, right?
Actually, no.
Okay, good.
I read a story this week that has made an impression on me. And the story is there's a ship full of people. And in the bottom of the ship, there's a tavern with some strange noise coming out. And one of the passengers peeks in and sees this passenger busily drilling a hole in the bottom of the boat. Mm-hmm. And he goes, "Stop! You can't do that! Stop what you're doing!" And the guy turns around and he says, "What business is it of anyone else's what I do in the privacy of my own cabin?" Yeah. And I thought, what a powerful thing.
Yes.
Because all of what you shared doesn't even touch the damage that's done when someone breaks in on a covenant between two people who already are married.
Yes.
The whole boat goes down. And then all the people who knew the boat, all the people on the boat go down. Yeah. And the ripples never stop.
No, they never stop.
I just thought that was
a great story. That's a great story. Yeah. Yes, Jim.
In your account of George MacDonald, when he had the choice to
take it or leave it,
do or not do.
Yeah.
It was in a bar, but it could be anything.
Anything.
But in the book, was it descriptive of he could do or not do because he had the flimsy thought of perhaps he had this thought, or maybe you even was wondering if he was saying that I'm born again, so I can do this sin. I'm a child of God.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think so many times I think what happens is we learn hear so much about God's grace, God's grace, God's grace, God's grace. It's much like our political climate where all people hear about my rights, my rights, my rights, my rights, what I've got coming toward me. What is it we're missing in our political climate today? Our responsibilities. And I think in our spiritual climate today, the same thing. God has promised us, if you keep my commandments, if you guard my words and hear my voice and keep my statutes, then he talks about the flood of blessing comes our ways. You see, obedience is not for salvation. Obedience is for blessing. And we don't hear much about that. We are saved completely and totally by God's grace. But our reward and our blessing is based completely upon our obedience and our works. They're not contradictory to one another at all. Not at all. Not one bit. Okay? You know what? I'm going to share one story. I wasn't sure if I was going to, but I've been reading the most wonderful book. I recommend it to all of you. It's called Pebbles of Wisdom by Rabbi Aden Steinsaltz. I always talk about the sages. People wonder if there's a sage alive today. If there's a sage alive today, I think it's Rabbi Aden Steinsaltz. An incredible, incredible intellect. And this is what he writes. And this applies to so many different things. He says, I had a friend. He was older than me, but for a time I became his teacher. He was on a long path to religion or spirituality, and it was for him a way of suffering. At one point, I told him about procession caterpillars. I'd never heard of procession caterpillars to this. I don't know if you have or not. But this is fascinating. Procession caterpillars. They go in a line, one after the other. You see a whole line of caterpillars, each touching the other, and they are going in a procession. Perhaps they're searching for food. Biologists experimented with them, and one experiment had almost political implications. One caterpillar leads, the others follow. Why is the leader a leader? What made him into being a leader? They found out that the leader is a leader because each has the instinctive feeling to follow the tail of another caterpillar. Now, there was one caterpillar who didn't find a tail, so he became the leader by default. So that's the leader, the one that didn't find a tail. In order to prove it, they did something that is, in a way, unkind. They arranged them to form a circle, the first caterpillar touching the last. They work by instinct, and so they walk in a circle. And they go like this until they die. Always in the same circle. I said to my friend that sometimes people go in this kind of circle in their spiritual life. And the only way to solve it is to cut it. You have to cut the caterpillar-like circle by will, and then you may go in any direction. The circle means death. Moving, but staying in the same place. There are people who lead that sort of life for years. And I'm not speaking just about material ways of life, but spiritual as well. A person has all kinds of driving impulses, but no solution. You come to the same questions, the same answers, and so you move in a circle. You don't move anymore. You don't move anywhere. Isn't that interesting? Always moving, but not moving anywhere. How do you get out of it? You cut the circle. And you know, that applies to so many different things. So many different things. You know, the spiritually, physical habits we're in, the habit of thinking, well, this is just the way I've always done things, so I'll just continue to do them this way. That's like a mindless caterpillar. Mindless caterpillar. And what you do, you have to cut it. And quit following a follower and follow the leader, you see. Let's close in prayer. Father, we thank you for this time together. We thank you for the wisdom of your Torah. And I pray, Lord, that nothing I have said today would come across as offensive, but enlightening, something freeing, something instructive. And Lord, I ask your protection upon our young people who have not yet entered into marriage. Dear God, open their eyes to the fire that they're literally playing with. Lord, it's more than a fire. It's almost like a nuclear bomb. It can be as destructive, or Lord, it can be a power source for the rest of their lives. Dear Lord, give us respect for the gift you've given us. And Lord, may we keep it pure. And may it be a consistent and everlasting source of joy and unity in our marriages. So Lord, bring healing where damage has been done. I pray you will help us to begin the work of repair, where we just accepted the notion this is just the way it is. Help us to break out of the mindset of just being a caterpillar, always moving, but never getting anywhere. And Lord, help us to break out and be a leader, to follow you, regardless of where the rest of the pack goes. So Lord, make us the people you want us to be. We'll give you the glory for that. In the precious name of Yeshua, our Messiah and Savior. Amen. Well, let's stand together. And I'm going to ask Ben again to come forward, do the bracha over the the cup and the bread. By the way, there's several people, visitors who've come in, and they look at what we do and think, why is it when you do communion, we don't all do communion? This isn't communion, all right? This is a convenient way of us doing the blessing before we go eat. And I'm even thinking maybe we should start doing this in the room where the food is. But that means going from order to chaos and trying to restore order again over at that end of things, which I'm not sure if I'm ready to try to do. But this is a communion. This is a blessing over the cup and the bread, just blessing God for the food he's provided us. And once this is done, you can go and just chow down in the other room. All right? Oh, yes. And I should probably turn off the recorder because people on the tape really want to hear this. Bye-bye.